Welcome to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast, the beliefs and culture of people who made this cluster of northerly islands their home. From music to psychogeography to what to do if you notice the devil following you to church. It's a long, strange trip, and there are no guarantees you'll be home in time for dinner. Hello, welcome to our sixth episode, the final instalment in our popular mini-series Still Waters Run Deep. The dipping of a careful toe into the cold waters of the Welsh lakes, becoming acquainted with the Gwragedd Annwn, or the Ladies of the Lakes. Enjoy. In our last episode, we heard the tale of the Lady of Llyn y Fan Foch, arguably Wales's most famous story of a man's encounter with such a woman. But there are others, many others. Meet the Lady of Llyn y Fan, the name of which translates as the Maiden's Lake. It is said to be the home of Nell Fuch. In Ferndale, South Wales, a man became obsessed by a young woman who tended a herd of milk-white cattle nearby. In a similar theme as before, the woman agrees to be with him on the condition that he doesn't raise his voice at her three times. And you know the rest. They lived temporarily in the pleasure of each other's company, and each morning she was heard singing to her white cows until, at last, the farmer breaks their contract. As a somewhat charming footnote, Peter Stevenson, in his enjoyable compendium Welsh Folk Tales, writes that a girl from the local primary school, when asked if she knew the story, replied that not only does she know it, but that she's seen the lake lady on her way to school, and that she's heard her singing. There's a wooden statue of Nell Fuch nearby, which cuts a rather enigmatic, although slightly sad figure in the twilight, charred by fire a few years ago when arson was popular with the Valley Boys. Still, she stands looking on, an atmospheric reminder that keeps this lake's folk heritage, although almost forgotten, from disappearing entirely. Be sure to pay her a visit. There's also a second tale, a much more sinister one, attached to this body of water in Darren Park. A man was going to marry a local woman, but, in secret, he loved another. In order to get rid of the hassle of his bride-to-be, he suggested a date at the nearby lake, and then pushed the woman in, holding her down, drowning her. For a long time, local residents spoke of seeing a figure dressed in silk walking alone, or even coming out from the waters of the lake. Some have reported hearing shrieks and the sound of splashing water. A few tell of seeing a half-naked woman emerging out of the lake, her wet hair hanging lankly over her shoulders. Whether this event occurred or not in the first place, this second, darker tale gives the aforementioned statue even more poignancy, I think, a kind of folk memorial to help us consider not only the beauty and the mystery of water, but also the danger. Let's now head north, up into the breathtaking landscape of Snowdonia. North Wales is, in part, a land of craggy mountains, mist-shrouded peaks, and glassy lakes. Its association with myth and legend dates back far, the stories inextricably intertwined with the landscape. I like that so many of the lakes and mountains in the national park have stories attached to them. It's not just another pool of water or peak, therefore, but we're reminded of their significance, their role, for the generations of people who really knew this landscape as we briskly hike through it. On your journey, you might hear tales of a water monster known as a navanc, swimming in the depths of Lake Llyn Cai. There's also Nessie's slightly more camera-shy cousin Teggy, who's said to haunt Wales's largest lake, Llyn Tegid. The travel guru's Lonely Planet write that sightings have been reported since at least the 1920s, and even as recently as summer 2006, do you know, with one Rodri Jones, whose sheep farm extends to the lake's foreshore, swearing he saw a crocodile-sized creature moving through the waters on a still night. But let's now meet at the base of the Snowdon Ranger Path at the Lake Llyn Cwethlyn, also known as the Fairies Lake. In Celtic folklore, Welsh and Manx, John Rhys tells a story that had originally come from Mari Doma Sean, who died around 1850. A shepherd had once lost his way in the mist on the mountain towards Cwethlyn Lake, where we now stand. And he'd got into a ring where the Tylwyth Teg, that's Welsh for the fairy folk, were dancing. It was only after a very hard struggle that he was able, at length, to get away from them. In some versions, the lad returns to find the landscape of his home much changed, as if many years have passed. A second tale connected to Cwethlyn Lake, where we now look out at, says that a lad from Betosgarmon found and captured a fairy woman. Eventually, she agrees to marry him on condition that he never struck her with iron. If he were to do so, she would return to the lake, to her people. Well, stop me if you've heard this one before, but one day, the inevitable happens, and he accidentally taps her with his horse's stirrups, and she flees home. Apart, however, from one night when she came to her husband's window to ask him to care tenderly for their children. Let's now leave Lake Cwethlyn at the foot of the mountain. Make sure your walking boots are tightly done up as we now proceed to climb the ranger path up to Mount Snowdon. Not too far from its peak, you'll see three lakes named the Blue Lake, the Red Lake, and the Snake's Lake. Well, it's the Red Lake, or Llyn Coch, that concerns us now, for the final instalment of the Fairy Bride motif. A man often used to visit this lake, the Red Lake, to fish. If you now look down at the water, you can imagine him sitting there. One hot day in autumn, he, as he often did, stopped at the lake, where his horse thirstily lapped at the water. He began looking idly at the ripples when, to his intense astonishment, he became aware of a face just beneath the surface, a little distance from him, looking up at him. As he gazed bewildered, the head and shoulders which belonged to the face emerged from the water. He rushed towards the figure. When he got there, the vision had vanished, but it instantly reappeared in another part of the lake. Again, he rushed towards it, and again, it disappeared. This happened a third, a fourth, and a fifth time, after which the man gave up and went forlornly home. The next day, the man went to the lake once more. For a long time, there was no sign of her. To pass the time, he took out of his pocket some apples given to him by a neighbour and began to eat. Only then, the lady appeared in all her dazzling beauty, almost close to him, and begged him to throw her one of the apples. From here, he worms his magic, and the tale follows the same pattern as before, this time the agreement being that he shouldn't touch the lady with clay. Well, she no sooner receives the inevitable muddy touch than she makes a great and exceedingly bitter cry, running into the lake and disappearing beneath the smooth and glassy waters. Now we've reached the top, let's stop and rest here at the peak of Mount Snowdon as we consider our journey so far and the stories we've encountered. You might be noticing a bit of a theme to a portion of them, something about unions with the other world having conditions that mortals are unable to keep. Tragedy for the families then ensuing. But what are we to make of this, sitting here thinking about these tales in the 21st century? If we focus on the otherworldly bride motif that does indeed keep cropping up, we can marvel that, despite the amount of time that's elapsed since the tale's origins, and the distance the location many of the lakes are from each other, how incredibly tight these stories are. As we sit here looking out at the stunning landscape of jagged peaks and valleys with their lakes below, we're reminded that from here, it's over 140 miles distance from the most southerly lake we visited earlier, the waters in Ferndale, where we met the wooden statue of Nell Ferch, the other side of the country. And yet, the story of the fairy bride remains incredibly similar to its Snowdonian and Brecon sisters. Of course, there are differences, namely the specifics of courtship, and whether the lady was tempted with bread or with apples, etc. These often smack of the specific soil they're from, and it can be rewarding to pull at some of these threads to see what you can pick out. However, despite these differences, you'll of course have noticed that if we dig and find the core of each, it's that core that almost perfectly mirrors the others. Mortal sees woman-like figure, eventually she agrees to be with him, but there's a prenuptial condition, honey. Man says, yes, 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 no problem, dear. Man breaks contract, woman leaves, often bringing her milk-white cows back with her. It is also often noted that the man is then quite broken. In one tale, he wades into the lake, attempting to drown himself in the same waters that had once been so enchanting. The reason I took a while in previous episodes to really flesh out the one tale of Llywaslawn and the Lady of Llynyfanfoch is because taking time to really sink into the heart of one of these tales helps us to really consider the attraction, the wonder which the man is described as feeling, but just as importantly, the tragedy. It follows that taking time to get a real sense of this helps when looking at all the other variations too. We have an important centerpiece at least. It might be helpful here to attempt to give some kind of a context. Many scholars think elements of this family of lake tales date from the late Middle Ages, which although that might sound impossibly far away, in the grand scheme of the human story of course, and certainly this landscape is not that distant. Especially when we consider the tales may have far older elements built into them also. Thinking about the migratory path of stories as people move, there's also the possibility they were transported to the lakes from elsewhere. But a potential blending shouldn't diminish our enjoyment of these incredible stories. Something to keep in mind is that there was clearly a core element within them that was deemed important. Important to tell and retell and retell. So here we are, almost unbelievably, in the year 2020, retelling them again. Thinking about them. We can then not only enjoy these stories, but also think about the different elements preserved within them. I'm quite a visual person, and I often imagine these elements as types of precious gems, created both through pressure from the landscape, and then from the handling of people who polish them, chipping bits off here and there, down 20 generations pressed from palm to palm. In this way, we don't need to feel disappointed these stories are far away from us in time, but rather see this as a type of testament of their power and their relevance to a part of our minds. So, as some of the latest inhabitants of Earth, it's now our turn to scoop these gems up in our hands, seeing light play on their many sides as we now consider their strange beauty for ourselves and the long journey to reach us. So our first question might be, what is up with the lakes? Let's look at the setting. The lady is invariably not up a tree. She's not just over there lurking by the bins, she's not around the corner, but she's certainly, definitely either in a lake or she is next to a lake. In some longer versions of the Water Bride story, they lead up to the tale by mentioning certain lakes have been seen as doorways to the capital O, Other World. Avenues of communication, as W. Sykes writes, between this world and the world of Anun. This reference to another place is sometimes lost in the retelling and the variations of the tale. But without this, due to us appearing to be ever more literal-minded today, we might perhaps infer we're being told a lady is physically living within a lake, maybe with a large family and many cows too, from the sounds of things. A separate challenge is if the other world is mentioned, if the audience aren't well versed in their folk tales and their mythology, the term other world might conjure up some sickly Disney stamped and approved fairyland where all your dreams come true. These two readings, the literal human woman breathing underwater and the modern culturally bound Tinkerbell infested take on a fairyland, both relegate these lake tales to the nursery. With these interpretations, anyone interested in such material might be seen as somewhat detached and in denial of the modern world, of which these tales have seemingly no connection, no relevance. However, and you probably felt that coming, there is a whole lot more to the story, as they say. A belief in the other world is incredibly ancient, and with all sorts of nuances that don't necessarily translate well in a 90-second retelling. The belief in other worlds beyond this, and that they can occasionally be accessed through the landscape itself, is a core part of a wider tradition and a rich spiritual belief. In the Celtic literature, as well as the Welsh Anun, in Irish, names for it include Tiatinger, the land of promise, Marmel, the pleasant plain, and most famously, Tiernanog, the land of youth. Not taking a moment to stop and acknowledge this spiritual heritage in reference to the other world is akin to getting some scissors and beginning to cut away at central portions of a spider's web. We're then left with the corners and outside hanging, wondering how it got there in the first place, what it could all mean. We can take care to study each folktale and myth individually, of course, whilst also saying there are a number of themes, I think that's the best word, which appear to be remnants of this other way of seeing the world. To get in the zone, perhaps we can imagine what moving through a landscape, let's take Snowdonia since we're already here, might actually feel like if we perceive it firstly as being actually sacred in itself, crackling with its own kind of awareness, and secondly as being slightly more malleable than we perhaps perceive it today, as if other worlds might gently interact with each other, and where in pools of water, burial mounds, or in liminal between spaces, there might be a very occasional slipping. Dr. Karen Rawls MacLeod, in her incredibly detailed scholarly work, Music and the Celtic Otherworld, that is a book recommendation, if ever there was one, of a rare caliber and filled to the gills with references. She writes that in Celtic literature, liminal places pertain to certain everyday locations, such as a doorway, a windowsill, a cave opening at the side of a mountain, or the famous crossroads. These serve as a kind of portal or bridge between this world and the other world. It's not hard to see parallels between these ideas and the Welsh lake tales, in which the lakes are actively being described as portals of types. When I earlier said there are nuances to this otherworldly belief that are tricky to quickly capture, one of them is regarding this liminality. It's not only physical places, but also time we have to consider. To paraphrase the great Irish storyteller Eddie Lenihan, if you were out on May Eve, you were considered out of your mind. Which is to say, if you decided to go walking on the evening before May 1st, you were taking your life in your own hands, as this was the night when the fairies and other beings not from here were on the move. It's not noon in the second week in July, it's the eve of May the 1st, which we might know as May Day or Beltane. Folklore is chock full of time-specific references and dates in the calendar that widely held certain associations. I'm sure you can think of a bunch yourself. One that instantly popped to my mind is that if you run round Chanctonbury Ring 3 times at midnight on Midsummer's Eve, the devil pops out from behind some trees and offers you a bowl of soup. Thank you, that's very thoughtful. Despite an endless chain of Chinese whispers, people adding little touches until we're here thinking about a steaming bowl of midnight devil soup, even here we can still see the idea of liminality preserved. It's this blending of a person in a certain place at a certain time. And in the Chanctonbury Ring example, we also have the action running in a circle. We understand the instruction that these things are required together, in tandem. A more everyday example of the time aspect might be the idea of 12 midnight being the so-called witching hour, the liminal hour between night and day. Whether we pay any attention to this or not, we're still familiar with this way of thinking. Taking this idea of liminality and approaching the lake stories with it, we could perhaps infer a body of water is enchanted only to a certain person at a certain time. Do with this what you will. It should probably go without saying this is just the idiomatic tip of a gigantic iceberg, and we will get into the other world in many more episodes to come. But since this is our first official encounter with this other place on this podcast, as obvious as all this might sound, I still think it can be helpful to acknowledge that there can be a bit of a cultural gap when we approach some of these old stories. Even as an obsessive story collector, I found it's helpful just to put the brakes on and to consciously change gear when approaching this material, and that my relationship with it is all the richer for doing this. Of course, we often find that fairy stories for children, structured simply and thus easy to remember and pass down, very important. Actually, when you look closely, contain a treasure trove of social history inside, serving as a reminder that we haven't always moved through the world in the way we do today, and that in the future, we won't either. Perhaps one of the most popular theories in regard to the Welsh Lake Tales is that they contain remnants of water deity worship. We depend on water for our very existence, so it's not really a surprise people have long attributed divine properties to it. These aquatic forces were venerated and given offerings. They still are. Think of the many holy wells of both pagan and Christian significance that dot the landscape. So the next stop on our journey is the Lake Llyn Cerrigbach on the Isle of Anglesey. Don't worry, we will drive this one, where a number of fine quality items have been recovered that were believed to have been offerings to the deity of the lake. These include bronze and iron weapons ranging from swords, spears, daggers and parts of shields, fittings from chariots, cauldrons, tools, musical instruments and an incredibly beautiful piece that's likely the most famous of them all, the stunning Crescentic bronze plaque in the shape of a gold lunula. If you're not familiar with this piece, feel free to pause me and do a quick internet search to view this beauty. Some of the items appear to have been of local manufacture, a few were manufactured in Ireland, but many originate from southern England, suggesting either trade or plunder capture, or that the fame of Llyn Cerrigbach as a holy site may have spread well beyond the immediate area. Here come the tourists. When considering this find, it must be recalled that Anglesey was also the last bastion of Druidism in southern Britain. A European parallel might be the Lake Neuchâtel in Switzerland. When the water level fell, more than 3,000 votive offerings to the lake were found. Whilst it's really easy for these words to just roll off the tongue, if you really consider them, the offerings of these incredibly fine objects, symbols of both power and artistry, given over an extended period of time, show the people had a serious dedication to this practice. It's not one crazy weekend gone wrong, it is a relationship spanning generations. Whatever you feel about this, it's at least interesting that the image of appeasing a water being can be found within the Lake Lady stories. We can also note the giving of bread or apples, and that the lady only leaves the lake when, in these versions, the correct offering has been given. We can think of poor Llywelyn with his various stages of baked bread, where despite being rejected and the lake lady's no-nonsense attitude, he doesn't give up but continues to make pilgrimages to the lake, continues to make his wheat-based offerings. So we've considered the other world and we've considered evidence of types of lake deity worship, but now I'd like to tilt our minds to consider some of the properties of water itself. We wouldn't confuse water's calming, peaceful effect with it somehow being passive. Whilst in one hand we can think about its serenity-inducing qualities, we can also think about its changeability and its unbelievable power. Just because it has the ability to sometimes appear still, inviting, begging you to come in for a swim on a hot summer's day with the sun sparkling on its surface, doesn't mean we're not aware the wind might quickly change, and that same water that had once invited us in could take our life too. I think here it's time to come full circle as we again return to the Lady of the Lake from the Legends of King Arthur, who we waved to 2 episodes ago on our way to the west of the Brecon Beacons to meet Llywelyn. Let's find her again now that... I think I can see her just there by the opposite bank. Just the image, the symbolism of the sword coming from the lake is just irresistible. So Excalibur, a weapon of swift action and righteous power, is, as we know, only given to Arthur out of these watery and, in comparison to the sharp blades of a sword perhaps, seemingly inactive depths. But whilst the lake might have looked still from its surface, we know it is actually far from that, and just that it holds a different kind of power, a creative and initiatory one, one that's able to produce the mythic weapon in and of itself. This image is a great meditation on different kinds of strength, but also that the greatest kind of strength, perhaps, comes from not just starting on anyone who annoys you, but from contemplation and awareness, or more succinctly put, getting your shit together. It's the wisdom of Corydwyn's cauldron and the initiation of the Wells of Brigid. We often find water and initiation linked. One of the most obvious examples might be baptism, the submerging of the body within water as a dedication, a taking on of new responsibilities, a new chapter in one's life. And I had absolutely no intention of talking about this, but just when I was thinking about water and initiation there, I had a really strange image pop into my mind, which was when I was initiated into a cult known as the Brownies. For any international listeners, that is the younger wing of the Girl Guides, And for our initiation ceremony, we stood up in our village hall, surrounded by our peers and parents, and one at a time entered a circle in which there was a large oval mirror on the floor, styled to look like a kind of lake. On one side there was a huge, life-size, fluffy owl, and on the other there was some kind of a toadstool. We then made the salute with our hands, which I'm doing now, as we recited the Brownie Pledge, all the while making eye contact with ourselves through the waters of the lake, the mirror. After this, we were reborn as a brownie. That sounds incredibly intense, and whilst this symbolism might not have been picked up on by a bunch of 7-year-olds, I'm sure it wasn't lost on some of the creators. The pictures of the ceremony are particularly interesting, where both my sister and myself have facial expressions I've never seen before. Half pride, the family are there to see you, mixed with half pure terror. I think this is quite interesting because it shows you don't necessarily have had a really religious upbringing for some of this water symbolism to have seeped into other parts of life, including the Girl Guides. Let's just take the word reflective itself. In a lake, we might see distorted branches of trees, or perhaps our own face reflected back as we lean over the edge of a boat. But to be reflective as a person means you're more likely to be a bearable human being. We've probably all met people in our own lives who don't reflect on their actions and how these impact other people as much as they might. And you might have noticed these people are really hard to have a relationship with. This nice little slice of watery wordplay just helps us to consider some of the other connotations of water too. Well, we're nearing the end of our whirlwind watery trip through Wales. It's been quite a day. We've visited 3 other lakes that have similar lake lady stories to Llynifanvoch. We quickly stuck our heads into the other world, headed over to Anglesey to check out precious votive offerings to a lake deity. On the way back, we waved to King Arthur's lake guardian, who we spied through the mist once more, before stopping by a rural village hall to find a bunch of 7-year-old girls pledging allegiance to a cuddly owl. Not to mention, we climbed Mount Snowdon. A quick point to note about these past few episodes: although we've been focusing on the famous Lady of the Lake motif, we have only scratched the surface in terms of legends attached to Welsh lakes. These bodies of water, extensive, silent, mysterious, and often particularly remote, possess a very characteristic mythology regarding visions, fantastic beings, ancient cities, lost islands, and magic that must be studied as a unique branch of Welsh folklore. We've thought about some symbolism and cultural significance of water and lakes, but on the way out, let's be sure to also appreciate their actual physicality within the landscape for a moment. And for this, I'd like to give the floor to celebrated nature writer Tristan Gooley. Tristan writes, "Lakes offer some of the best opportunities for us to notice how our awareness of water is growing. I used to charge past large bodies of water in places like the Lake District, not entirely oblivious to the beauty of the landscapes around me, but certainly blind to the intricacy of that beauty. I did not see how deciphering ripples could enhance my journey to a local peak. It would take thousands of paces to reach the places I planned to get to and back. One of these steps would have triggered a reaction in a swan, which in turn would create a unique pattern in the water, as it sent ripples to interfere with those of a wind eddy. In the past, I may have been delighted in the freshness of the air and scents on the breeze, but I would never have spotted that these scents fluctuated in a way that was etched into the water beside me. Now I view lakes and their patterns in a different way. They are a summit in their own right. If I take the time to notice the behaviour of the birds, fish, insects and breezes through the map of their actions in the water's surface, this becomes a conquest of another kind, a higher summit. Happy lake gazing. Be sure to stay to the end of today's show music, as I have a little treat in terms of archival footage on Mudvai. If you listen to the first two episodes in this series, you'll know that in the folktale, Llywathlon and the Lady Llyn Ifan Vach go on to have three sons, and so the story goes. These three sons grow up to become great doctors, the physicians of Mudvai. Even aside from this watery connection, the physicians of Mudvai are a fascinating study just in their own right, tracing this family line and their pioneering of early medicine. These were historical figures who can be traced back to the 13th century. And it's this fertile ground where history and folklore intertwine that is so irresistible. If this is of some interest to you, head to Mudvai Church, St. Michael's, where you'll find the last remaining physician in this line, John Jones, who died in 1789, buried here. Meaning, if our dates are in the ballpark of being correct, this medicinal line was kept going for around 500 years. For perspective, that's 200 years more than the time from John Jones's death in the 1700s to today. Today, we might think of it as an accomplishment keeping a family business going two or three generations. Just imagine that chain of dedication and hard work, and of course knowledge, behind five centuries. After stopping by the church, why not head to the Botanic Garden of Wales? Here you can enjoy the Apothecary's Garden, which has an entire bed specifically showcasing plants that were recorded as being used by the physicians of Mudvai. Finally, thank you to you for taking this journey since October with us. Thanks also to William Britton for the Mudvai footage, and you can find this linked in the show notes. So it's now time to consult the heavens and hedgerows for the final part of 2020's almanac. Tomorrow, the 14th of December, it is the new moon. From there on, open your curtains to chart our silvery satellite as it grows fatter until the full moon on the 30th of December. This moon is known as the full cold moon, the oak moon, or the Old English Anglo-Saxon name, the moon after Yule. Not too much imagination in that last one. The moon is the highest and brightest of the year. In the year-round wrestle, or perhaps dance between night and day, night certainly appears to be winning at the moment, as precious moments of sunlight continue to be cinched away. The moon shines high and bright and strong over the winter countryside, just as the sun stays low. Be sure to have a drink with the winning team this month, and cast your eyes upward at the night sky to enjoy its chilly splendour. Furthermore, one of this month's names for the moon, the oak moon, reveals some treasures. We can first think of the oak as being a symbol. When winter is in full reign over the earth, it is important to remember the oak's endurance. To survive the trials of winter, people must find within themselves the oak's great strength. However, the oak moon might well be an ancient reference to the practices of the Druids, where mistletoe was harvested from oak trees with great ceremony. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder in the 1st century CE records that the Druids, that is what they call their magicians, hold nothing more sacred than the mistletoe and a tree on which it is growing, provided it is a hard timbered oak. Mistletoe is rare, and when found, it is gathered with great ceremony, and particularly on the sixth day of the moon. Hailing the moon in a native word that means healing all things, they then banquet beneath the tree. A priest arrayed in white vestments climbs the tree and, with a golden sickle, cuts down the mistletoe, which is then caught in a white cloak. They believe the mistletoe given in drink will impart fertility to any animal that is barren, and that it is an antidote to all poisons. Duly noted. Pliny's account has been considered to have really contributed, at least, to the popular depiction of druids today, as white-clad wise people performing rituals in the forests and equipped with golden sickles. Even deep into pop culture, in the Asterix comics, the druid Getafix is often depicted amongst oak trees, robed in white and, yep, bearing that golden sickle. It's interesting to trace the roots of these... Oh, no pun intended. But what's the fixation with mistletoe in the first place? Well, it was regarded as sacred. Part of its attractive symbolism is that it's home to neither the earth nor the heavens, but being parasitic, it's perched upon the tree between earth and sky, in a liminal place, therefore, a little touch of heaven that we can still climb up and harvest with our very earthly hands. It can also be seen as containing the life spirit of the oak, for in the winter months when certain species are void of leaves, the mistletoe sits upon it, its leaves still a rich green. And when I read Pliny's account, my eyebrows raised at the idea of the plant imparting fertility. There's a rather well-known Christmas ritual of kissing under the mistletoe, you might have heard of it. Not in an adjacent room, but directly under goes the instruction. So in this theatrical and light-hearted act, we can see a pretty straightforward fertility blessing. Beyond this, a kiss that not only bestows earthly fulfillment, but also the heavenly, the divine, as symbolised by mistletoe itself in plant lore, wedged between the ground and sky. What more could you want? There's some nice symbolism too with those lovely green leaves, a wish that the couple's good fortune continues, even in the most challenging of times. So, a great excuse to string some up this Christmas, even if the only person you're kissing is yourself. That's the moon and mistletoe dealt with. What about the sun? As you know, we can firmly look forward to the days beginning to lengthen by minutes from the 21st onwards. In easterly Lowestoft, by December the 31st, the sun is rising at 8:03, setting at 3:48 in the afternoon. In westerly Dunkeen, it is rising 10 to 9 and setting at 20 to 5. We can look forward to taking some time out on the fast approaching winter solstice to appreciate our life-giving sun and welcome its triumphant return. You've been listening to Folkways, the Folklore of Britain and Ireland podcast. The piece Many Points of Light by Judson Lee, the rest of the soundtrack by musician Josh Sandifer. Logo design Jim Fisher, words written and read by myself, Ashley Claire Harron. Any additional artists, locations and work featured, as well as useful links and sources can all be found in the show notes. If you enjoyed today's episode and would like to support our work, feel free to leave a tip when you leave this particular cafe by following the link to Buy Me a Coffee. Please also feel free to leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. This can help others to find the work and take enjoyment from it also. Thank you. Off Pure Terror. Thank you.
project, we the young people of Mugby have explored the legend and legacy of plants used in our village, connecting plants, people and places through memories, capturing the essence of Mugby and its unique heritage, past and present. The land and plants tell a story of life in Mugby, evidence of the importance of plants in our parish dates back to the physicians of Mugby. An unbroken practice of using plants in the home and on the farm for over 8 centuries is kept alive today through memories, stories, and importantly, use. In medieval times, Mugby was renowned throughout Europe for being a centre of plant medicine. This wisdom of plants and medicine is wrapped in mysticism, the legend of the Lady of the Lake, which has helped preserve and carry this knowledge forward.
It was Rhiwallon and his 3 sons, Cadogan, Gruffydd, and Einon, and they had lands in Mugby to support them as a living, but to give their medical services free, especially to the poor. And that continued for about 5 centuries, up to the middle of the 18th century, when the last 2 of the doctors were buried in Mugby churchyard, David Jones and his son, John Jones, in 1739. There are 13, 14th century documents relating to the Muddugum of Mugby. And of course the Muddugum of Mugby collected, you see, about 800 remedies. They were not all theirs, possibly from the Druids, Hywel-Dda, or possibly Hippocrates, the Greek, the father of medicine, so he's referred to. They do say that Middle Ages and earlier, medical practice in Wales was far more advanced than anywhere else in Europe. Because of mainly, or partly, the doctors of Mugby.